There is this very specific, almost cinematic moment in every great drama where the background music just suddenly cuts out, the harsh fluorescent lights flip on, and everyone looks around the room to realize that the party is decidedly over.
Right, the honeymoon phase is dead.
Exactly. And most importantly, the bill is finally arrived. So welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are looking at the sudden, often brutal collision of grand ambitions with, well, unforgiving realities.
It's just such a fascinating dynamic to study because ambition is, it's absolutely necessary to build anything of consequence, whether that is a new government, a geopolitical peace treaty, or like a multi-billion-dollar tech empire. But ambition without a really solid, unshakable grounding in reality is basically just a very expensive, highly public illusion. And when that illusion cracks, the fallout is spectacular.
Totally. And our stack of sources for you today is essentially a masterclass in those exact illusions shattering. We are pulling from some recent political reporting out of the UK, some highly sensitive diplomatic dispatches from the ongoing peace talks in Switzerland, and a stack of deep-cut financial analysis on the current highly volatile state of the tech sector.
Yeah, and it might seem like a really diverse stack of sources on the surface, but the through line here is undeniable. Across every single one of these arenas, we are seeing what happens when the gap between the promised vision and the mathematical reality just becomes, well, too wide to ignore.
Right. Now, just setting the table for you today, we are looking at sources that cover some incredibly charged events. I mean, we've got the sudden collapse of left-wing political mandates in the UK and high-stakes maneuvering involving right-wing figures in US diplomacy. So I just want to say, our goal here isn't to pick winners, or take political sides or endorse any of the specific policies we're discussing. We are simply here to dissect the mechanics of what actually happened, convey the factual events, and explore the ideas contained within this material so you can understand the underlying forces at play.
Yeah, we're basically looking at the machinery of these events under a microscope. We want to understand the how and the why, completely independent of all that partisan noise.
Right. So let's start with a collapse that happened with just, I mean, breathtaking speed. The fall of UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer.
Unbelievable how fast it went.
Yeah, he just announced his resignation. And this is barely 2 years after winning a historic landslide majority in the 2024 election. To go from that level of perceived invincibility to stepping down in just 24 months is wild. So, what actually broke inside the machine here?
Well, the underlying reality simply caught up with the electoral math. I mean, Starmer came into power largely because the previous conservative government had just completely exhausted the public's patience. It was a vote against the status quo, right, rather than a passionate vote for Labour's specific agenda. And once they were actually in office, Labour genuinely struggled to define what they were actually for. By November 2025, Starmer was looking at a devastating net approval rating of negative 46%.
Negative 46. I mean, that is just brutal.
It really is.
It means almost half the country actively disapproves of your performance, well beyond just the baseline of normal political friction.
Exactly. And that level of public dissatisfaction, it doesn't just sit in the polling data, It translates into real structural electoral damage. In the May 2026 local elections, Labour took a massive hit. And the most shocking data point from the reporting, they lost Wales. Yeah, Labour had not lost Wales in an election since 1922. Over a century of absolute regional dominance just gone overnight.
Okay, let's unpack this because looking at his leadership style, it reminds me of a very specific corporate archetype. Starmer was acting like a turnaround CEO.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
You know the type, right? They get hired by the board, they come in, they fix the spreadsheets, they clean up the internal compliance, which he did, to be fair, fixing the party's previous highly publicized issues with anti-Semitism.
Right, he did the administrative work.
Exactly. But turnaround CEOs completely alienate the actual employees and the customers. They manage the decline efficiently, but they fail to establish a unifying vision that makes people actually want to buy what the company is selling.
Yeah, that is a highly accurate analogy because turnaround CEOs are hired for administration, not inspiration. The problem in politics is that when the structural cracks inevitably start appearing in the government, you need a deep reservoir of foundational public goodwill to survive them.
Which he just didn't have.
Right. Starmer governed as an administrator, so he didn't have that goodwill. And those cracks were, well, they were significant.
Right. Let's look at the mechanics of those cracks because the sources point to two massive fractures that really brought the house down. First, the Peter Mandelson appointment scandal.
Yes. So Peter Mandelson was appointed as the UK ambassador to Washington, which is, you know, arguably one of their most critical diplomatic posts.
Absolutely.
But it later leaked that he had actually been explicitly denied security clearance by UK security vetting back in January 2025.
Wait, how did that even happen? If you fail security vetting, isn't that just a hard stop?
Normally, yes, it should be. But the Foreign Office essentially pushed the appointment through anyway. The reporting indicates they put serious pressure on senior civil servants to just ignore the vetting failure and proceed with the appointment.
Which is a terrible look for a prime minister whose entire personal brand, his whole unique selling proposition to the public, was built on restoring competence, transparency, and a rules-based order.
Exactly. It shatters the illusion of the administrative CEO.
But the second fracture was arguably even worse, because it dealt directly with national security and global instability. The sudden resignation of Defense Secretary John Healey.
Yeah, Healey's resignation was really the fatal blow to the administration. He quit in June 2026, and he did not go quietly.
Not at all.
He publicly stated that the government's defense spending plans were completely insufficient to meet the threats posed by the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine and, crucially, the 2026 Iran war.
Right.
He explicitly stated that Starmer was unable and the Treasury was unwilling to provide the necessary funding to keep the country secure.
I mean, when your own defense secretary walks out during a period of active global conflict and says you are actively failing to fund the military, your mandate to govern is basically vaporized.
Gone.
Which triggered some of the most fascinating political maneuvering I have ever read about to replace him. I want to talk about the orchestration of the Makerfield by-election. Because to get Andy Burnham into power, the party essentially had to, like, hack the parliamentary system.
What's really fascinating here is just the lengths they had to go to. In the UK parliamentary system, by convention, the prime minister needs to be a sitting member of parliament. And Andy Burnham, who is the highly popular mayor of Greater Manchester, was the clear favorite to step in and unite the fractured party. But he wasn't an MP. He was outside the building, so to speak.
So a sitting Labour MP named Josh Simons just resigns his seat in Makerfield. He artificially triggers this sudden by-election in a safe district, purely to parachute Burnham into parliament so he could immediately challenge for the leadership. That seems incredibly risky, you know, gambling a seat just to maneuver a specific person into play.
The fact that they took that risk shows you just how desperate the party was to find a visionary leader after the administrative approach collapsed.
Yeah.
And Burnham won the by-election, and the moment he was sworn in, Starmer saw the writing on the wall and resigned.
So the ultimate lesson from Starmer's collapse is that in the 2020s, voters aren't hiring politicians just to manage the spreadsheets. They will ruthlessly fire you if you can't provide a compelling vision for the future.
Absolutely.
And Burnham is inheriting a deeply fractured party. He has the leadership title, but he doesn't actually have a clear policy mandate from the general public.
Exactly, because Starmer's downfall happened because he just couldn't balance the ledger between his grand administrative promises and the grim reality of his resources. And right now, diplomats in Switzerland are wrestling with that exact same brutal math.
Oh, that's a great point.
They're trying to buy short-term geopolitical stability with resources they can't actually control.
Which leads us perfectly into the diplomatic dispatches from the U.S.-Iran ceasefire negotiations at the Bergenstock Resort. I mean, talk about ambition violently colliding with reality.
It's intense.
The contrast in these reports is jarring. You have these high-minded, sterile diplomatic goals being negotiated in a pristine Swiss resort, clashing with the messy, volatile realities on the ground in the Middle East.
Yeah, and the talks are being mediated heavily by Pakistan and Qatar, which makes a lot of sense given the geopolitical landscape.
Right. Qatar has the money.
Qatar has the financial leverage and the communication channels, while Pakistan holds unique regional sway and, you know, nuclear status. But they are trying to bridge an incredibly wide gap.
So let's look at the actual mechanics of the 60-day roadmap they're trying to hammer out. The U.S. has agreed to end its naval blockade and has issued what's called a General License X, or GLX.
Right.
Now, for anyone not deep in international trade law, this isn't just a hall pass. It's a bureaucratic mechanism that temporarily lifts secondary sanctions.
Which is huge.
It means global banks and shipping companies can suddenly process Iranian crude oil transactions for the next 60 days without the U.S. Treasury freezing their international assets.
Exactly. And in exchange for this massive economic relief, Iran has agreed to allow United Nations IAEA nuclear inspectors back into the country, and they've guaranteed safe, toll-free passage for commercial shipping through the Strait of Hormuz.
Okay.
The immediate overarching goal here for the U.S. is to de-escalate the military conflict and bring global oil prices down quickly.
Right, but I have to push back on the underlying logic here. If the U.S. is essentially giving Iran this massive economic lifeline, allowing them to sell oil on the open market again, plus the reported release of roughly $6 billion in previously unfrozen assets currently sitting in Qatar, how does the U.S. guarantee that money doesn't just go straight into funding the very proxy groups causing the chaos in places like Lebanon?
Well, that is the multi-billion dollar question keeping diplomats awake at night. The cold truth is, there are no ironclad guarantees.
Really? None?
None. The parties have agreed to set up a deconfliction cell specifically for Lebanon to try and enforce a termination of military operations.
But based on the dispatches, this deconfliction cell sounds like, I don't know, hiring a bouncer for a bar fight, but giving the bouncer absolutely no authority to actually kick anyone out.
That's a pretty good way of putting it.
Because Iran insists the U.S. must completely control Israel's actions in Lebanon, while the U.S. insists Iran must rein in Hezbollah. It relies entirely on mutual trust, which simply does not exist.
No, it's an incredibly fragile mechanism, and that fragility was almost shattered entirely by the rhetoric happening completely outside the negotiating room.
Right.
While the technical teams in Switzerland were meticulously trying to hammer out this delicate 60-day roadmap, Donald Trump went on Fox News and social media issuing explicit ultimatums. He threatened to resume bombing Iran harder than ever before if they didn't immediately comply with U.S. demands.
Which fundamentally changes the psychology of the negotiation.
Completely.
I mean, the Iranian delegation was reportedly so furious about these televised threats that they staged a dramatic walkout. They completely refused to participate in the planned handshake and the joint photo op with American officials.
Yeah, that was a tense moment.
The Pakistani prime minister literally had to send his interior minister to chase down the Iranian team in the resort just to keep the entire summit from collapsing right there in the hallway.
It just highlights the extreme danger of modern diplomacy. You cannot easily negotiate the nuanced mechanics of a delicate ceasefire when the public messaging surrounding it consists of loud ultimatums and threats of bombardment. And this extreme volatility is absolutely terrifying to the U.S. allies in the Gulf region.
Well, yeah, because they are the ones physically caught in the crossfire.
Exactly. The dispatches note that U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is currently rushing through the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Bahrain.
Because of their bases.
Right. These nations host major U.S. military bases. They have already been hit by Iranian missiles during this 2026 conflict. So they are looking at the ceasefire deal, seeing the unfreezing of billions in assets and the resumption of oil sales, and their anxiety is through the roof.
Understandably.
They fear this deal is simply going to plow cash directly back into Iran's military apparatus, funding the missiles pointed at their cities.
So Rubio is essentially on this massive high-stakes damage control tour, trying to reassure Gulf allies that the U.S. isn't inadvertently bankrolling their biggest regional threat just to get a short-term dip in crude oil prices.
It is the ultimate precarious balancing act. You are basically trading long-term regional security fears for immediate short-term relief in the global energy markets.
And the General License X did achieve that immediate goal. I mean, it immediately dropped the price of crude oil, bringing some much-needed relief to the pump.
It did.
And this brings us to the third part of our deep dive. While that geopolitical deal temporarily saved the energy markets, that same grace period absolutely failed to save Silicon Valley from its own brutal reality check.
Yeah. The bill coming due in the tech market is perhaps the most quantifiable collision of ambition and reality we are looking at today.
We are witnessing a massive market rotation, and the split screen on Wall Street right now is just wild. To look at the numbers, you had the Dow Jones representing the broader traditional economy climbing 167 points. But at the exact same time, the tech-heavy NASDAQ dropped 1.1%.
And that divergence is really crucial to understand because investors aren't panicking in a broad sense.
Right. The sky isn't falling.
Exactly. They aren't liquidating their portfolios and hiding cash under the mattress. They are rotating capital. They are taking money out of the incredibly crowded mega cap AI stocks. You know, the capital's promising the moon and spending hundreds of billions on artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And they're moving it into the companies that actually manufacture the physical chips, like Micron, which was up 4%. They are also moving into traditional value stocks and small cap companies.
It's the classic gold rush dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
The people selling the picks and shovels are doing fantastic, but the people actually digging the mines, searching for the gold, are suddenly looking very exposed.
Very exposed.
Just look at Alphabet, Google's parent company. Their stock took a brutal 6% hit in a single trading day. And the financial analysis points to two massive realities hitting them simultaneously.
So the first reality is the staggering, almost incomprehensible cost of the AI infrastructure required to compete. Alphabet has officially guided that their capital expenditures, their CapEx for 2026, will be somewhere between $180 billion and $190 billion.
Yeah, I mean, they are spending money like they're trying to single-handedly colonize Mars.
Seriously.
That is an astronomical amount of cash to pour into data centers and compute power before you have a clear, mathematically proven path to profitability for those specific investments.
Right, but the market was willing to tolerate that spending when they believed Alphabet had an impenetrable competitive moat. But the second reality hitting them shatters that illusion.
It's a talent issue.
Yes, a severe brain drain of their absolute top AI talent. John Jumper, the co-creator of the revolutionary AlphaFold system, just left Google DeepMind to join a rival startup, Anthropic.
Wow.
And Noam Shazir, a key architect of modern AI, left for OpenAI.
Yeah, you cannot spend $190 billion to win an AI arms race while your top generals are actively defecting to the enemy camps. It signals to investors that the technological lead Google thought it had might be much shallower than expected.
Exactly.
The market is suddenly extremely intolerant of companies burning cash on ambition without a guaranteed return. Which brings us to the wildest story of the week, and really a perfect case study in the mechanics of market hype. Elon Musk's SpaceX.
Ah, the SpaceX post-IPO plunge.
They just went public. They had their highly anticipated initial public offering. They hit the market, and then, well, they lost $600 billion in market capitalization in just 3 days.
It's hard to even picture that number.
$600 billion.
Yeah.
That is almost half the total value of all Bitcoin in existence, completely wiped out in 72 hours. How does the math on a drop that size even work?
It really comes down to the mechanics of how SpaceX chose to go public. They listed on the exchange the tiny public float.
Meaning what exactly?
This means only about 4 to 5% of the company's total outstanding shares were actually made available to be traded by the public. The vast majority of the shares remain locked up by insiders and early investors.
Okay, I see.
So when you have a very small number of shares trading on the open market, any shift in demand causes extreme volatility.
So it's like cramming a massive crowd of eager buyers into a tiny room, and then someone yells fire, and everyone tries to squeeze out through one tiny single-file door. The price just gets crushed.
That's a great visualization.
But what was the catalyst? Like, why did the crowd suddenly rush the exit?
The catalyst was SpaceX announcing they were issuing $20 billion in corporate bonds. They needed to take on this massive debt specifically to pay off bridge loans that Elon Musk had previously used to acquire his separate AI company, xAI.
Wait, so let me make sure I have this straight. Investors realize they just handed the company tens of billions of dollars in an IPO, and almost immediately the company says, hey, we also need to borrow $20 billion more to cover the debts of this completely separate artificial intelligence venture.
That is exactly how the market read it, and it forcefully dragged investor attention back to SpaceX's underlying financials.
Those weren't great.
No. According to their filings, SpaceX actually posted a net loss of $4.94 billion in 2025. The core space exploration and the satellite internet business, Starlink, are reportedly profitable. But the AI segment tied up in this ecosystem is a massive, uncontrollable cash incinerator.
Wow.
The market woke up from the IPO hype, looked past the rockets, and stared directly at the balance sheet.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because the psychology of this entire AI market dynamic feels incredibly familiar if you look at market history. There is deep research in our stack from the Cowles Foundation that points out a terrifying parallel between NVIDIA today and Cisco back in 1999, right at the peak of the dot-com bubble.
The parallels in the research are striking, and honestly, they are deeply concerning if your portfolio is heavily weighted toward the current AI boom.
Right. The report notes that NVIDIA is currently trading at roughly 23 times its total revenues. I want to be super clear on that that's not a multiple of their profits. That is 23 times every single dollar that comes in the front
door.
Well,
that's a massive multiplier.
Back in 1999, Cisco, the company building the physical networking infrastructure for the early internet, was trading at 19 times revenues. Analysts joked at the time that to justify that valuation mathematically, Cisco would have to sell an enterprise-grade router to every single person living in America.
Which is absurd.
Right. And today, you could argue NVIDIA needs to sell a high-end GPU to everyone on Earth just to justify its current price tag.
This raises an important question about the psychology of the investor. What happens when that exponential growth inevitably begins to slow down? In 1999, Cisco was the ultimate one-decision stock.
If you didn't own it, you were losing.
Exactly. You were underperforming your peers. Everyone bought in because the narrative of the internet changing the world was entirely true.
But the narrative being true didn't save the stock from being wildly overvalued.
Yeah.
The bubble burst. And the kicker from the Cowles report is just chilling.
It really is.
Because Cisco's underlying business didn't fail. In fact, it continued to grow over the next two decades. Their earnings went up nearly eightfold since 1999. But 24 years later, Cisco's stock price has still never recovered to its 1999 peak. The valuation has simply priced in decades of flawless, uninterrupted growth that reality could never perfectly deliver.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, whether we are talking about a prime minister losing his mandate because he couldn't unite his party with a vision, a fragile geopolitical ceasefire hanging on the whims of social media threats and zero trust, or tech giants realizing that AI infrastructure actually requires hundreds of billions of real dollars, the lesson is remarkably consistent. Gravity eventually pulls everything back to reality. You can only suspend disbelief or ignore the fundamental math for so long. Eventually, the bill comes due.
And that is exactly the question I want to leave you with today. When you look at how you evaluate momentum in your own life, whether you are observing the momentum of a political movement, judging the supposed success of a foreign policy strategy, or watching the soaring stock price of the latest AI darling in your retirement portfolio, how much of what you are buying into is based on solid, undeniable fundamentals? And how much of it is just the fear of missing out?
It is the crucial difference between investing in reality and merely speculating on ambition.
Definitely something for you to mull over as we wrap up. Consider this final thought. During the spectacular, devastating crash of the dot-com bubble, the massive telecommunications companies that spent billions laying expensive fiber optic cables across the ocean floors went totally bankrupt. They spent the money, and the market crushed them.
Yeah.
But that cheap, abandoned infrastructure was eventually bought up for pennies on the dollar by the survivors, and it paved the literal way for the entire modern internet we use today. So if today's AI hyperscalers crash under the crushing weight of their own $190 billion spending habits, who will be the ultimate beneficiaries of the massive empty data centers they leave behind?
Now that is a truly fascinating thought to end on.
We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.